Hi, and welcome to this week's reading of the Arts and Leisure section of the Sunday New York Times. I'm Rob Lund, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the February 11th issue. Our first article is about performances in New York City. It's entitled Joan Later Keeps Broadway in Tune, written by Alexis Solosky. For 41 years, Joan Later has rented a slender studio apartment just west of Union Square in Manhattan. Through its door, a narrow entryway leads to a doll-sized bathroom and an efficiency kitchen. In the main space, where a visitor might expect to find a bed, Later has arranged the instruments of her trade: a piano, a keyboard, balance balls, straws, a box of tissues, a skeleton in a jaunty hat. Later has never advertised, never solicited clients. But for two generations of Broadway stars, as well as dozens of opera singers and pop and rock luminaries, she remains an indispensable vocal therapist and vocal coach. She even received a Tony Award in 2016 for excellence in theater. And while proper breathing is fundamental to her practice, she has scarcely paused for breath since that award. She continues to work 7 hours each day, 7 days a week. "I wish she would take a break," Patty Lapone, a longtime student, told me. For Later, who is 77 years old, the work is her calling, a synthesis of artistry, science, and, according to her clients and fans, something akin to magic. "I've called her a witch in front of people many times," the music director Rob Fisher said. "I've never seen anybody else do the hocus pocus that she sometimes does." The composer Tom Kitt can nearly always tell when a singer has been working with Later. "They have opened up in the beautiful way," he said. "They are empowered, and they feel confident." I met Later on a wintry afternoon last month. She had struggled to find time to see me, but a cancellation had opened a narrow window in her schedule. She showed me into her space, noting the 8-inch soundproofing along the wall that borders the apartment next door. "Cats paid for that," she said. Later has worked with the likes of Madonna, Paul Simon, and Sting, as well as throngs of Tony winners. But like a lawyer or a priest, she keeps that confidential. She won't disclose her clients unless they have disclosed their affiliation first. What happens in the studio stays in the studio. Later is slight, bird-like almost, with a focused, energetic, no-nonsense manner that made me correct my posture. Though they are roughly the same age, Betty Buckley, another client, will only address her with the formal Miss Later. "Because she is really such a master," said Buckley, who has worked with her since fraying her vocal cords in the mid-1990s while performing in Sunset Boulevard. "I love her completely. I'm a devotee." As a New York City child, Later hoped for a career in modern dance. Martha Graham, who visited the dance studio she attended, dissuaded her. "She said something about cheekbones," Later said. "She said all dancers have to have cheekbones, and you don't have any." But a talent for music won her a spot at the High School of Music and Art, which later became the Fiorello H. LaGuardia High School of Music and Art and Performing Arts. On a whim, she chose voice over an instrumental track and continued those studies at Penn State, where she branched out into theater. After graduation, she returned to the city, picking up voiceover work, often for radio. Radio commercials didn't pay enough for her to move out of her parents' place, so she took an administrative position at the Hospital for Special Surgery. That job offered a stipend for graduate school, so in the 1970s, Later enrolled in the speech program at Hunter College, assuming it was theater-related. In fact, the course emphasized speech pathology and audiology. "I had no idea that there was science involved," Later said. Fortunately, the science fascinated her. She knew how to sing, but she had never understood how she sang, the precise mechanics of breath, mouth, and vocal folds. That might have been the end of it, as she was soon hired by the Light Opera of Manhattan as a mezzo-soprano. But even as she pursued a performing career, Later could not let go of vocal therapy. Knowing that she was a singer, she said that Mount Sinai Hospital, where she had completed an externship, began to refer injured singers to her, trusting her with their rehabilitation. A few years later, she rented the Union Square studio and relinquished performance. She has been booked solid ever since. Much of her work still deals with rehabilitation. She helps singers dealing with polyps, nodules, hemorrhages, cysts, acid reflux, vocal fold swelling. She showed me a terrifying slideshow depicting these various ailments and disorders. Lupone first met with later in the mid-1990s after a vocal cord operation. "I couldn't talk, I had nothing," Lupone said. Later began with Lupone's speaking voice, then rehabbed her singing voice. "She saved my career," Lupone said. "She gave me a technique to allow me to continue to sing with the strength and the clarity that I've had ever since." Billy Porter contacted later in the early 2000s, having lost his voice to acid reflux. Porter's voice had always had a gospel sound, a rock sound, which was atypical of Broadway performers back then. During their sessions, later never tried to change that. "She was one of the first teachers that I met who was not about squashing that," Porter said. The other side of her practice involves healthy singers who are new to a role, who are struggling in a role, or who want to expand and improve their voices. Often performers come to her in a kind of existential panic because they no longer understand how they do what they do. She encourages singers to relax and to open their whole throats, which isn't always comfortable. "When you're totally free, you're really open, and some people don't want to be open," she said. "So you have to be very, very careful and supportive and not critical." If later is careful and supportive, she is also wholly professional. "She doesn't lie to you," the Broadway performer Charlotte Damboise said. "She doesn't say, 'That sounds great,' if it doesn't sound great. She's honest, straightforward. There's no hand-holding. I mean, there's some to a point, but she's there to make it right." Later is typically on retainer for a handful of Broadway shows. At the moment, those include Chicago, in which Damboise has long performed, Moulin Rouge, Spamalot, and Sweeney Todd, seeing any performer who requires coaching. Casey Cott, of Riverdale fame, has been working with her since he was cast in Moulin Rouge as a replacement Christian. "She's incredibly intuitive, which is so important because singing is such a vulnerable thing," Cott said. He also marveled at the variety of the exercises she assigned him. Balance challenges, chair poses, pretending that your ears are being tugged upward by balloons. Those exercises, she'll admit to dozens, possibly hundreds, are drawn from a multiplicity of methods, techniques, and the work of past masters. Alexander, Feldenkrais, Joe Estill, Arthur Lesac. "We do lots of poses in here," later said. "I'm on the ground with them." Beyond yoga, later relies on a host of gadgets, straws, sing rings, sing necklaces, and a network of osteopaths, chiropractors, massage therapists, and psychotherapists to whom she can refer clients. Later can't do everything. She can turn a bad singer into a good one and a good singer into a better one, but she can't supply that ineffable quality that makes a voice distinctive. "You're born with that," said Later, who rates her own voice as good though not exceptional. She has some qualms about never having made it to Broadway. She and the director Hal Prince used to talk about a walk-on. But she does not regret her career, and the hulking file cabinets that dominate one wall, filled with scores and folders for each client, testify to her influence and care. Singers who spoke with me called her a virtuoso, a miracle worker, a lifesaver. Later's own assessment was more pragmatic. "I guess I'm in the right field and I'm doing what I should be doing," she said. Our next article is about dance. It's entitled "A War-Haunted Choreographer Steps Into a New Role at City Ballet," written by Marina Harse. For the choreographer Alexei Ratmansky, the last 2 years have brought an uncomfortable intermingling of life and art. Known for ballets that combine wit with an almost surrealistic imagination, he has found his thoughts drawn insistently toward the war in Ukraine, the country where he spent his early years and began his dancing career, where he met his wife and where their families still live. "My parents in Kyiv are awoken by explosions at night," he said in an interview at Lincoln Center. It gets harder and harder and heavier because no one sees any light. I can't stop thinking about it. There is one image in particular that he can't get out of his mind. A photograph of a father kneeling next to his 13-year-old son killed at a bus stop in Kharkiv during a Russian airstrike. The man stayed there for hours, holding the boy's hand. Ratmansky, age 55, has kept the image filed away, part of a mental gallery of the horrors of war. Now it has found its way into a dance, his first for New York City Ballet in his new role as artist in residence. The piece, Solitude, set to music by Gustav Mahler, premieres on Thursday. "I didn't plan to do a ballet about this picture, but it haunts me," said Ratmansky, who has a son in his 20s. "To convey something so dark in point shoes with pirouettes and partnering, it almost feels like I'm entering forbidden territory." It seems right that Ratmansky, arguably the most important ballet choreographer working today, is entering that territory at New York City Ballet, where he has made some of his most personal and original work, tapping into the furthest reaches of his imagination. Because of the company's repertory, built on the ballets of George Balanchine, and because of the dancer's ethic, it's about the choreography and the music, not about them, he said. Ratmansky feels an open-endedness in the creation process here. "I can say, let's go in this direction," he said, "and I know that something will happen." The feeling is mutual. Wendy Whalen, City Ballet's associate artistic director, who first met Ratmansky in 2006 when she was one of the company's star dancers, said in an interview that having him in the company after knowing him as an artist, it feels like we have a diamond in our toolbox, something to care for and protect and keep safe. Ratmansky has a long-standing interest in the company, co-founded by the Russian-born Balanchine, who altered the look and feel of ballet in the 20th century. But Ratmansky's arrival at City Ballet was not a foregone conclusion, and it didn't happen in a straight line. He first caught a glimpse of the company as a ballet student in Moscow in the 1980s, when a teacher quietly passed on a video cassette of Balanchine's Apollo, danced by Peter Martins and Suzanne Farrell. Ratmansky had the feeling of seeing something forbidden and new. In Soviet times, Balanchine, who abandoned Russia for the West in the early 20s, was not part of the official ballet training. "It made a huge impression," Ratmansky has said of the video, particularly in its pared-down style and the simplicity of presentation. Determined to understand the style better, he taught himself the steps to another Balanchine ballet, Tarantella, from a videocassette. He danced it at a competition in Moscow, which he won. In Canada, where he moved in 1992, just after the end of the Soviet Union made such moves possible, he was able to work with former City Ballet dancers who helped him acquire Balanchine's streamlined, stylized modern approach to ballet's 19th century vocabulary, characterized by speed and keen musicality. Ratmansky's favorite thing to dance became Balanchine's square dance. "I love the feeling that you could just ignore everything and be connected to the music," he has said. "It was quiet, like meditating on stage. That was a discovery for me." Drawn to City Ballet's repertory, he auditioned twice for the company in 1993 and 94 during summers off from the Royal Winnipeg Ballet. He didn't get in. Ratmansky began playing with the nuances of the music even as a student and has a great love for the classical vocabulary. He was so attracted to Balanchine's approach to ballet because it represents a complete system, a very, very beautiful classical system, he said. "The steps, the musicality, it combines many things. I think what is most important for me is the connection with the music." He was also drawn to the way the company's dancers performed, their sharpness and attack, and the way the technique extended the lines of the body. "Because of the school and because of the Balanchine technique, the City Ballet dancers shape the material in a very specific way," he said after a rehearsal. "They have certain tools that color everything they do." After those city ballet auditions in the 90s that went nowhere, there was a moment in 2008 when it seemed that Ratmansky might join the company as a choreographer in residence. By then, he had become a well-known dance maker and as the young director of the Bolshoi Ballet in Moscow, a job he began when he was 35. He tried to lead the Bolshoi to a new repertoire and more contemporary way of working. It was not easy. At the end of his turbulent tenure, tired of conflict, he entered talks with City Ballet, where he had already made a work, Russian Seasons, from 2006. But those negotiations fell through, and he accepted an offer from American Ballet Theatre instead. The ensuing years were a period of rapid growth for Ratmansky, both in variety and output. Besides the 18 ballets he created for Ballet Theatre, he made works for companies around the world at a feverish pace. These encompassed small, poetic ensemble pieces, elaborate tongue-in-cheek story ballets, and, beginning in 2014, detailed, historically informed stagings of 19th-century ballets that involve the study of period dance notations. He is an unabashed student of ballet history. But he never stopped working at City Ballet, creating 6 ballets for the company, including Concerto DCSH from 2008, Namuna, a Grand Divertissement from 2010, and Voices from 2020, that had a distinctly different flavor from those he made elsewhere, often more abstract, wilder, stranger, fleeter. Now, after almost 14 years at Ballet Theatre, he has finally joined City Ballet in its 75th anniversary season as an artist in residence, alongside the choreographer in residence, Justin Peck, who is also the company's artistic advisor. "The idea that he might come to us was everything. It was exciting," Whalen said of Ratmansky, especially for the dancers who had worked with him. Whalen, who took part in the creation of Russian Seasons, has said she was transformed by that process. "We were really sorry to lose him then," she said of 2008, "but now there is new leadership and the time and opportunity looked right, and we offered him an opportunity to reside with us."
"It's a new chapter," Ratmansky said, "for both him and the dancers. I'm excited to give them material that will help them develop, not just in this work, but through several pieces, to go somewhere together."
Inevitably, this new chapter is colored by the events in Ukraine. Ratmansky, who has been vocal in his condemnation of Russian aggression, has seen his name removed from the works he created for Russian companies. He and his Ukrainian wife, Tatiana, spend their evenings watching Ukrainian news and scrolling through Ukrainian websites that chronicle the deaths of soldiers and civilians and the effects of missile strikes. All the while, life in New York goes on around them as usual. That dissonance makes things feel even more surreal.
"Death is all around," he said, "and here I am walking around safe. It's a strange feeling."
A sense of tragedy piercing through everyday life infuses his new work, Solitude, set to 2 movements of Mahler from the 1st and 5th symphonies. The first selection is a funeral march, the second, slow, glistening composition for strings and harp, the Adagietto. Written as an expression of the composer's passion for Alma Schindler, who would become his wife. Mahler's funerary procession, the setting for the ballet's first section, moves between a relentless forward drive, set to a minor key version of the melody from Frère Jacques, klezmer-infused passages inspired by Mahler's Jewish roots, and more lyrical moments that offer a glimmer of hope. The mood shifts are abrupt. Ratmansky's corresponding choreography evokes scenes from life, some hopeless, some otherworldly, some almost giddy. As the father, played in alternate cast by Joseph Gordon and Adrian Dantchik-Waring, kneels next to his son, played by a student from the School of American Ballet, the rest of the cast of 14 enters in units of 2 or 3, performing jagged, angular steps that have them collapsing toward the ground. "They are like impersonal forces, the embodiment of things that happen," Ratmansky said. "Or perhaps they are just thoughts running through the father's heads."
When I sit there, even as they dance around me, I feel like I'm in this other place, said Gordon, a dancer who has the ability to convey a powerful sadness on stage. The Adagietto music, with its gleaming, fluid lines, introduces a more haunting tone. The man performs a solo, all deep pliés and explosive jumps and movements that stretch as far as the body can go to fill the music. It's so simple, but it conveys so much, Gordon said after a rehearsal. I can feel the emotions in my body as I do it. I feel like I'm looking into the void. Radmansky is remarkably hands-on in rehearsal, demonstrating the choreography over and over, standing in for partners, placing hands, suggesting minute adjustments until the movement captures the qualities he is looking for. He throws 15 things at you at one time and keeps getting us to try things over and over, said the dancer Sarah Mearns, who is creating a role, a kind of angel of mercy in the new ballet. He can get a dancer to just go beyond their own body. Demonstrating a phrase in rehearsal, Radmansky stretched so far in one direction that gravity took over, causing his body to tilt perilously. Almost save yourself from falling, he told the dancers as he took a step, stopping himself mid-fall, and use that momentum to transfer your weight. The mood during rehearsal was intense. It's crazy the atmosphere he creates in there, Mearns wrote to me afterward. He keeps everything and everyone so present. And though the focus was on getting the steps right and achieving a certain quality of movement, the gravity of the ballet's subject seemed lost on no one, least of all Radmansky. I've never seen him be so vulnerable talking about what he's processing every day, Gordon said. I think he might have become even a little more daring, Waylon said when asked how he had evolved in the 18 years since she first worked with him. I think that with all these changes in the world, he's broken free. Since the war? I'm different, Radmansky said. I'm very different. Still, by nature, he added, I'm not a dark person. I'm not moody. He has a relaxed rapport with the dancers and is still capable of conveying lightness and mischief through his choreography, qualities for which he is known. Just before beginning this project, he created a new Coppelia for La Scala in Milan that the Times said was notable for its joyfulness and energy as well as its humor. It is such a joy, he said, another world. In the fall, he started teaching a weekly company class at City Ballet, something he had never done before. It's new to me, so I had to work hard, he said. I was completely drenched in sweat after every class. But it's interesting, because in class you can work on the qualities you will need later in the studio. The City Ballet dancers' focus and eagerness stimulates Radmansky to try new things. I like to give them something that they don't use as often, more groundedness, more adagio, slow, drawn-out movement, maybe bigger volume, he said, and with it, perhaps more emotional resonance. Maybe unconsciously, I push them into a territory that is new for them. As I resume reading from the February 11th edition of the New York Times Arts and Leisure section, we will turn to TV. The article is, In the New Look, It's Chanel versus Dior in War-Torn Paris, written by Juliette Guérin-Gabriel, reporting from Paris. In the New Look, an Apple TV Plus show, premiering February 14th, wine glasses are never empty, cigarettes are always half-smoked, and everyone is thin. The series follows two titans of French fashion, Christian Dior and Coco Chanel, after all, toward the end of World War II. But this glamorous portrayal of Paris's creative milieu is also interested in how the French elite collaborated with their Nazi occupiers during this contested period. It offers a startlingly throwback to a time when swastika-stamped flags hung over the streets of Paris. From 1940 to 1944, the French Vichy regime collaborated with the Nazis and deported over 70,000 Jews to death camps, sent French workers to Germany, and tried to crush the French resistance. The show's main action starts in 1943. Chanel, played by Juliette Binoche, a star of French fashion, is living at the Ritz Hotel, which was then a Nazi headquarter, where she hosts her boyfriend, the German spy Hans Günther von Dinklage, played by Klaus Bang. Chanel was an excellent survivor, said Binoche, sitting on a couch in the wood-paneled bar at the Hotel Regina Louvre, which stood in for the Ritz on the show. Binoche, wearing a white shirt layered with a black bustier, tie, and pants, said she read several biographies of the designer to prepare for the role and was impressed by how Chanel's creativity and business savvy took her from childhood poverty to the top of the European elite. Playing the character in this period of her life was challenging, the actress added, because there's so many layers of gray going on. On the show, we see Chanel invoking Vichy's Aryan laws in a failed bid to eject her Jewish business partners from the company. She travels to Madrid at the request of an SS general in a bizarre attempt to broker peace between Germany and Britain. Winston Churchill, whom she knew personally, declines to meet. Her great rival Dior, played as shy and contained by Ben Mendelsohn, is not yet a famous designer. He works for Lucien Lelong, played by John Malkovich, creating evening gowns for the Nazis, even as he supports his sister Catherine, played by Maisie Williams, a resistance fighter who is eventually sent to a concentration camp. Mendelsohn, in a blue coat, sitting next to Binoche in the Regina bar, said he didn't approach his character by thinking about the morality of Dior's choices. "The start of modern acting is to empathize with your character," he said. "It's hard to play someone with a highly externalized idea of them. You have to climb in." The show's creator, Todd A. Kessler, who previously worked with Mendelsohn on Bloodline, was drawn to setting a show in occupied France because it meant characters were making decisions in extreme and fast-evolving circumstances, he said during the interview at the bar. "It's not as inspiring to think of anyone as a villain or as a hero," Kessler said. "Every person is many different people. Under different circumstances, you might respond differently." It was also essential, Kessler said, for the show to be shot on location, on the same streets that Christian Dior and Coco Chanel walked and lived, to be in the same cafes and hotels that the Nazis occupied. The new look reveals the tragic and hidden history of some of Paris's elegant buildings, recreating the Gestapo's torture house, just a couple of miles from the Eiffel Tower, as well as the interior of the Lutetia Hotel, which, after the war, housed returning camp survivors, its lobby crowded with desperate families hoping to find their loved ones. For decades after the war, successive French governments refused to acknowledge the brutality of the collaborationist regime and the silent support it enjoyed among large swaths of the population. In 1995, President Jacques Chirac formally recognized France's responsibility for deporting thousands of Jews to Nazi death camps. But recently, debates about the period of occupation have been heating up again in France, with some far-right politicians arguing that the Vichy government has been judged too harshly. Eric Zemmour, who won 7% of the vote in the first round of France's 2022 presidential election, has claimed the government saved French Jews during the war, disregarding any historical evidence. The country's largest far-right party was founded by Jean-Marie Le Pen, an avowed admirer of the Vichy leader Philippe Pétain. Marine Le Pen, his daughter, another prominent politician in that party, once claimed the French state wasn't responsible for the most notorious roundup of Jews in France during World War II. She has since tried to sanitize her party's image. For countries like the United States and France, who see themselves as beacons of light and democracy, it can be uncomfortable to face the past because we didn't live by those principles, said Sarah Fishman, a historian and the author of France at War, Vichy and the Historians, in a recent interview. To Binoche, the show's themes also felt personal. Members of her Polish extended family were deported to Auschwitz because they were intellectuals and hid Jewish people, she said. Her grandparents were separately detained by the Russian and German armies during the war, and afterward, her grandmother slowly made her way from Poland to the south of France. There was a lot of damage in the war, Binoche said. On the new look, high fashion helps revive the French spirit. After Paris's liberation, Lelong organizes what he calls an exhibition of hope, a miniature fashion show in an annex to the Louvre of more than 200 dolls, dressed in outfits created by designers including Balenciaga, Balmain, and Dior, since there was not enough fabric to fit human models. More than 100,000 people visited the showcase of French craftsmanship. The following year, in 1946, when bread was still being rationed in Paris and coal and fuel were scarce, Dior broke with Lelong and founded his own fashion house on Avenue Montaigne. His post-war collection, which became known as the New Look, was an instant hit and helped return Paris to the center of the couture world after London and New York had dominated during the war. People need to dream again, Dior says on the show as he watches his models walk a runway in long pink and white dresses. Very little, in fact, was new in Dior's collection. A comfortable reminder of France's pre-war glories, the look centered on a corseted, hyper-feminine silhouette with long skirts layered in taffeta and silk, a pinched waist, and small, tilted hats. He drew inspiration from the flowers of his mother's garden. The outfits were a world away from Chanel's designs of the 1920s, which had liberated women from the corset and given them outfits for hunting, sailing, and playing tennis, as well as attending cocktail parties. The House of Dior, now chaired by Delphine Arnault, helped design the dresses featured in the show and let Kessler roam its archives for inspiration. Chanel wasn't associated with the production. Binoche said she accepted the role right away and was drawn to the show's depiction of Dior and Chanel as artists, trying to create regardless of their circumstances. Dior and Chanel needed fine arts. They needed to be in touch with Cocteau, Stravinsky, Picasso, Max Jacob, she said. Following Germany's surrender, Chanel laid low in Switzerland, returning to Paris to be interrogated by government officials over her collaboration with the Nazis. She was eventually cleared of any wrongdoing. After the war, the purges and trials didn't go very deep, Fishman said. Only the people at the top were convicted. A decade after the war, Chanel moved back to Paris and started designing again. Her business thrived, while Dior crumbled, Kessler believes, under the pressure of leading his own fashion house. He died just 11 years after its opening. Chanel had a fortitude in her to face the world, the showrunner said. Dior wasn't built that way. Depicting the real lives and many complexities behind the two enormous fashion houses was important to Kessler. My hope is that people won't see the names Chanel or Dior in airports again without realizing that these were full people, he said. Going on with the Arts and Leisure section from February 11th, we turn to music. Author Hugh Morris, reporting from London, gives us Two Pianists Make a Life Out of an Intimate Art Form. It looked like some kind of grand music exam. The pianist Pavel Kolesnikov and Samson Tsui sat down at their instruments on stage at Wigmore Hall and began to play for an audience of two. The rest of their listeners were online. It was June 2020, and Kolesnikov and Tsui were, like virtually every other musician at that time, playing a live-streamed concert. Despite the hall's chilly emptiness, there was something heartening. Here were two musical and romantic partners sharing a bit of their domestic lives as they worked through a messy pile of sheet music spread out on a single Steinway piano. Now things are more or less back to normal. When they sat for an interview at their elegant Northwest London home recently, Kolesnikov had just returned from Copenhagen as a replacement soloist in Tchaikovsky's first concerto and was about to jump in Copenhagen again, to play Rachmaninoff's third piano concerto. He could be heard frantically recapping the piece as he walked down the street. It's not something you can just pull out of your pocket, he said. The pandemic forced Kolesnikov, aged 34, and Tsui, who is 35, to recalibrate. After so much time spent at home together, returning meaningfully to the genre of four hands music through which they had met, they emerged with a desire to dedicate themselves to playing as a duo. They signed to new management as both solo artists and partners last October, and will make their duo debut at Carnegie Hall on February 13th with their first album together to follow this summer.
"I consider this possibly the hardest form of chamber music," Kolesnikov said of the piano duet. "This genre is a very interesting merge of something that is extremely homely, extremely intimate, and private. Then one thinks, how do you take that on stage?"
The piano duet has always been closely tethered to the home. Grove Music describes it as a modest, essentially domestic branch of music, more frequently associated with a student's early experiences than with the public-facing openness of a concert hall. Part of that is because of its commercial function in history. The peak of the genre's popularity was in the 19th century, in a time of mass-produced pianos and sheet music, but before the advent of recordings. Shrewd composers saw an opportunity to take the concert hall into the home. Liszt adopted many of his orchestral works for multi-hands piano, and the entirety of Saint-Saëns' catalog was available in four-hands arrangements. The genre's domesticity and proximity has made close relationships a thread throughout its history, be they romantic, such as Clara and Robert Schumann, familial, as in Wolfgang and Nannerl Mozart, or a mixture of the two, Edvard Grieg and Nina Hagerup, his first cousin and later wife. But the essence of duetting involves an intimacy that goes even further, Kolesnikov said. "You forget about yourself and your reflexes become really superior to anything else." Kolesnikov and Tsoi first played together as students, and their intimacy is both the foundation of their approach to the genre and something neither of them sees in duet performances today. "Often you encounter this genre as a festival encounter," Tsoi said. "You have 5-10 pianists coming, and the festival director says, 'Tonight you will play Brahms waltzes four hands.' Then people go on stage, that's all they play, and they leave." "In such situations," Kolesnikov said, "there can sometimes be magical moments, but it almost never works. It's a shared heart, a shared soul that you somehow need to magically achieve," he added. "And that is something that can only come with years of experience and years of knowing and understanding each other." Kolesnikov, born in Russia, and Tsoi, born in Kazakhstan, met in 2007 at the Moscow State Conservatory. They chose the piano duet as part of their chamber music exams, and together they began tackling Rachmaninoff's Suite No. 2 for two pianos. The transition into being romantic partners happened organically, Tsoi said, like how everything seemed to happen in the conservatory living quarters. They lived with fellow artists, including the singer Elena Stikina, the conductor Maxim Emelianchev, and the pianist Dmitry Maslev, in the conservatory's enormous communal dormitories. Everyone spent almost every waking moment together, cooking, washing, showering, practicing, and discussing music. For two gay men, it was probably one of the best periods in Russian history in more than 100 years, Kolesnikov said, before Tsoi added, 20 years later, of course, we're in a very different situation." They lamented Russia's declaration last November of the International Queer Movement as an extremist organization. "It's absolutely mind-blowing," Kolesnikov said. "We couldn't imagine anything like that, even when we left." Kolesnikov and Tsoi moved to London in 2011, and the change was a shock, particularly financially. They had both received full scholarships to study with Norma Fisher at the Royal College of Music, but she said they had not a penny between them. When they visited Fisher's house for lessons, her husband would always cook for them. "Those two boys were starving," she said. "They had nothing." Things changed overnight in 2012 when Kolesnikov won the Honens, an international piano competition. But beyond the prestige of an important prize, he received $100,000 Canadian, a little more than $72,000 today. "Within weeks of winning the prize," Fisher said, "they were both wearing Armani." Their home today has an arrestingly tasteful living room, where during a recent visit they both sat on a bobbly sofa, as far apart from each other as possible. "They are chalk and cheese," Fisher said, "Pavel the poet and Samson the maverick."
but in conversation, the roles were almost comically flipped. Tsoi, relaxed and reclining slightly, offered louder yet more careful judgments. Kolesnikov, limbs curled underneath his body, delivered flatter opinions, so quietly and inwardly that sometimes they could barely be heard. As duet partners, the two seemed to feed off each other. Rather than meeting in some imaginary middle on stage, they take from both of their expressive palettes. The mix, to oversimplify, of Kolesnikov's more inward poetic exploration and Tsoi's tendency to more extravagant expressivity makes them ideal duo partners, Fiona Maddox, the music critic for The Observer, wrote in an email. Where they do meet is as aesthetes. A large red abstract painting hangs in their living room. It is by their first landlord, the artist Antony Malinowski, who rented them a basement flat after they moved out of school housing. Daily interactions with him and his artistic practice during their seven-year stay became a shining example of how to live their lives aesthetically. "Everything is extremely slow and extremely thought through," Kolesnikov said, "with absolutely nothing that is random, but also nothing that is put in place forcefully, and all arranged in a very gentle way." Kolesnikov and Tsoi's interests reach far. Couture, architecture, painting, photography, theater, glass, perfume, and of late, gardening. They take all those seriously, in pursuit of a deeper understanding of music through other fields. It extends to their auteurist approach to programming, which combines imaginative concepts with changes to lighting and acoustics. "It's like building a play," Tsoi said. "You're a director and you do everything." The result can be poetic or annoying, depending on your taste. Kolesnikov seemed to acknowledge as much in a solo recital at Wigmore Hall in November. Before Beethoven's Tempest Sonata in the first half and Schubert's Sonata in A minor, D 784, in the second, he played the same piece by Henrik Gorecki. "Repetitive sound," he wrote in a program note, "can be torturous or induce a trance." Kolesnikov and Tsoi will play more Schubert when they come to Carnegie Hall, the Fantasy in F minor, D 940, in the spirit of the programming following the four hands arrangement of Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring. The pioneering gay musicologist Philip Brett has written about the Schubert fantasy through a homoerotic lens, a praxis-derived reading of the work as performance of gay male desire. Kolesnikov and Tsoi are no strangers to similar readings of their own work. After a close-quarters performance of works by Bach and Kurtag during the Aldeburgh Festival last summer, Tsoi said a woman told him, "That was the most sexual thing I've ever seen in my life." Homoeroticism is one way to read into the Schubert, Kolesnikov and Tsoi said, but Kolesnikov often cites a line from Joseph Brodsky, "Our artifacts tell more about ourselves than our confessions." When any pair of artists is so entwined, there is always a question of what happens when things change for the worse, to which Tsoi casually responded, "What will happen if you get out of your house and the bus hits you? Or what if they break up?" "We never talk about that," Kolesnikov said quietly before a rare raising of his voice. "We only speak about what will happen if we don't have dinner after the concert." Now we'll switch to TV shows. The article is "Susie Essman, the Scene Stealer Who Makes Larry David Lose It," written by Milena Ryzik. The comedian Susie Essman spots them regularly, out in the urban wild. Fashion doppelgangers. We had barely begun our lunch at Café Luxembourg on the Upper West Side when she leaned in and gestured conspiratorially. "That's a total Susie Green outfit," she said, spying a woman entering the restaurant in a hooded salmon-orange jumpsuit cross-hatched with mint-green slashes. "And she's got a leopard print purse. Look at that." She sat back, delighted. Power clashing is the life force of Susie Green, the singular character that Essman has inhabited on Curb Your Enthusiasm since the HBO series created by Larry David began in 2000. There is no one in the entertainment universe who dares to dress like her, not just a clash, but a dogfight of pattern, color, and texture with a dollop of feather, and few who communicate as she does, in an ornery gush of inspired expletives. As Green, the much put upon wife of David's manager, played by Jeff Garlin, Essman is more than just a fan favorite. She is an instigator, a scene driver, as she put it, whose costumes and insults get even wilder on the 12th and final season of Curb, which starts February 4th. She is also the person who, her castmates said, makes David crack up most regularly. Essman, age 68, and David, age 76, the Seinfeld co-creator who stars as a heightened, less scrupulous version of himself, have known each other since their stand-up days in the 80s. He cast her in what was then a small part after seeing her withering set at a roast of Jerry Stiller in 1999. "She was filthy, profane, and hilarious, exactly what I wanted," David wrote in an email. He didn't give her much to go on. No character description or deep backstory, just telling her that the show would be improvised and that he and the on-screen Susie would have, he said, a contentious relationship. The rest was on Essman. She delivered. Her Susie is completely sure of herself and her outre style. And the haranguing turned out to be an unlikely emotional geyser. "What women especially respond to in her is her comfort with her anger," she said. It was a long generational shift. "I remember my father telling me when I go on dates that I should just listen to men and not talk," Essman said, and gave a Susie-level curse. "I'm not doing that." She doesn't see the big deal with four-letter language. If you say, you know, the friggin' or the freakin' instead of the expletive, you mean the same thing, right? Still, that's not how most of her interactions start. "People come up to me on the street and they're visibly disappointed when I'm gracious and kind," she said. "I mean, I've seen people's face drop." More often, they thrust out a phone and beseech her to call their husbands. It's almost always a husband. A few unprintable epithets. "I'm like, I'm buying a melon. I'm not in the mood," Essman said. But she obliges. It's not just viewers who vie to have her tell them off. "I wish she could have been upset with me," said a co-star of the comedian Richard Lewis, envisioning a spin-off where she just yells at him for 24 minutes straight. "She never seems to be struggling. This hostility just flows out of her. It's a beautiful thing to watch. She's the funniest, hostile character I've ever seen on television. Given the chance, I would have gone out of my way to screw up the scene just to make her angry at me." No one needs to yell cut to finish Essman off, either. "The scene ends with Larry just losing it completely," Lewis said. "And when he breaks, it gives permission to everybody. It's like an orchestra of laughter." In its two-decade-plus run, with a six-year hiatus between seasons 8 and 9, Curb has expanded its cast and its range of minor indignities that spiral wildly and absurdly from a lack of cashews in a trail mix to Susie smacking her lips after each sip of a beverage, setting off Larry. But production-wise, little has changed. There are written outlines for each episode story, which David works on for months with the showrunner, Jeff Schaefer, and a few plot points to stick to. The vast majority of dialogue is still improvised, and the characters definitely haven't evolved or learned to do better. "There's no growing and sharing in comedy," Essman said, "and there shouldn't be. The comedy is that you keep making the same mistake over and over again." She wasn't a series regular until about the 8th season, but the show changed her life, giving her more visibility as a performer and a financial bedrock. "I look around my house and I say, this is the house that Larry built," she said. Though Curb shoots in Los Angeles, Essman has never lived there. She splits her time between a new two-bedroom apartment on the Upper West Side, where she eventually hopes to retire, and a home upstate that her husband, a former contractor, fixed up, to the amazement of David, who is not, let's say, a DIYer. She married for the first time at age 53 and has 4 stepchildren, 2 grandchildren, and a deaf, one-eyed Shih Tzu. "I call him Helen Keller," she said. "He's old, he's cute, I'll get another one." Everyone swears she is not much like her Curb character. "Not only is she one of the sweetest people I've ever met in the business, she's one of the smartest," Lewis said. David added that in their time working together, "She's become one of my closest friends, brilliant and profound when it comes to life issues." Essman has been besties with Joy Behar, the comedian, writer, and TV host, for 40 years. Both suffered from stage fright and still navigated the territorial male-dominated stand-up scene of the 80s and 90s. They've had therapy and now help friends work out their issues in a psychodrama group that Behar runs, acting out the bad boss or the undermining sibling. She's great at it, like a duck to water, Behar said. Over lunch, where Essman was dressed tastefully in a fuchsia sweater, beaded necklace, and jeans, she snapped at no one, asked thoughtful questions, and cooed at a baby across the way. But she has her moments. Like the time, long before Curb, when she was living alone and scared away a mugger hiding by her door. She went full Susie Green on him, and he disappeared, Behar said. Growing up in Mount Vernon, New York, one of four children of a professor mother and a doctor father, Essman knew early on that she wanted to be a comedic actress. By age five, she had memorized the 2,000-year-old man, the Mel Brooks Carl Reiner album. The jokes were over her head, but it was the rhythm of it that I somehow responded to, she said. I would stand up on the kitchen table and recite both parts and get the timing perfectly. Her family would either scold or shrug. Her parents, she said, were never supportive of her career, even after her success. Essman recalled one of the last conversations she had with her mother, who died in 2017. She was like, I saw the show last night. Does anybody watch that? It's horrible, and you're hardly in it, and when you are, you're not very good. I was like, okay, bye, Mom, gotta go, Essman said dryly. She doesn't hold a grudge about it. For years, she did impressions of her family in her act. They made her tough, she said, a better comic. She remembers always trying to cheer up her depressed mother, make her laugh. I was not successful at it, so once I started doing stand-up, I was used to when I would die on stage. Essman sometimes went up without a full set in mind, just an opening, to see where things led. Then, thinking it might diminish her stage fright, she tried it the other way. Planned out, like a lot of her peers, but didn't enjoy it as much. I would have a premise, and the punchline would come to me on stage, she said. It was horrible and wonderful all at once. Offstage, Essman said, she could be analytical and self-doubting, but the Susie Green assuredness appeared early in her material. In one bit, she riffed on a boyfriend who she said broke up with her because she was too much of a Jewish American princess. I'm not a princess, she retorted. I'm a queen. She paved the way for raunchier comedians who followed. She's an icon, said Ilana Glazer, who cast Essman as her look-alike, brash-alike, curly-haired mother on Broad City, the Comedy Central series she created and starred in alongside Abby Jacobson. The resemblance is hilarious, physically and spiritually, Glazer wrote an email, and Abby and I looked up to Susie since we had been first drawn to comedy. The allure was all in Essman's chutzpah, apparent in her confidence as a performer and in the way she owns her feelings and knows who she is, Glazer said. It's motivating to watch and to be around. On Curb, co-stars calibrate to her, said J.B. Smoove, who, as one half of TV's best bromance, plays David's outrageous housemate Leon. Leon's thing is he gives Larry good bad advice, he explained. Hopefully he'll take my advice over this argument that he's having with Susie. But when she spits venom, he said, I do pull back because they cancel each other out. In the group dynamic of Curb, he said, everybody has a unique power. It's like a bunch of mutants from the Avengers, he continued, imagining how great it would be to see a rendering of the Marvel superheroes with the Curb cast members' faces. As the resident Lothario, Leon's superpower is obviously his dexterity with the ladies, though Smoove used more anatomical terms. Essman's version of the Iron Man suit is Susie's bonkers layering of bejeweled, befurred, besnaked outfits and miss-sized hats, created with costume designer Leslie Schilling. I don't think I've ever laughed so hard as in my fittings, Essman said. Sometimes she can't help herself and picks up things to add to the wardrobe. I was in Miami and, oh my God, the Susie Greens are everywhere. On set, the cast awaits her entrance like a fashion show reveal. Though she did ruffle David when she arrived this season with a new pixie-ish cut. Larry was like, it's very short. Yeah? So what? What do you care? I have hair, you don't. though some co-stars doubted that this was really the last season for Curb, given the lengthy break between seasons, Essman was more certain. She grew teary-eyed at the thought. It was a job and a life experience unlike any other, thanks mostly to David's vision. I completely trust his comedic instincts and the production's camaraderie. As Green, I never have to think about being funny, she said, which is a truly amazing release. And now, author Catherine Shattuck tells us about Violet Bean in an interview and some of her favorite things. She doesn't know if she believes in ghosts, but there was that incident aboard the Queen Mary, the retired British ocean liner reported to be haunted, while she was shooting Death and Other Details, her new Hulu murder mystery set at sea. Our hairstylist at the time said that she felt like a hand come across her and wind on her neck, Bean said. She ran out of the room and just freaked out. There's no freaking out on screen when Bean's character Imogene Scott is thrown together with Rufus Coatsworth, once the world's greatest detective, played by Mandy Patinkin. He's a legend, Bean said of Patinkin. He brings this sort of magnitude with him, and he never misses. You just learn so much from that. In a video interview from her home in Los Angeles, her own artwork on the wall behind her, she spoke about these following things. Charlie Kaufman. Every film he makes is a different world. It follows different guidelines. It follows different rules. I probably have 3 on my top 10. She likes fishing. It gets you in the sun, you're out in nature, you're tapped into yourself, and you can't really focus on anything else. It's almost like meditating. She likes looking under plates at restaurants. It's a joke in the ceramic community that we don't do that. But honestly, every time I'm at a restaurant, I flip the plate upside down and like, how did they do that? Then she is a big thief. Adrian Lenker, I think, is the best songwriter of our time. The way that she tells stories from beginning to end, you just know that she's opening up and bearing herself. I saw them live at the Wiltern in LA, and she's rocking out. Next on her list are clashing patterns. I find color and patterns fascinating. Sometimes I step out of my house and my friends are like, Violet Bean, what are you wearing? I don't know, but I like it. When I was younger, my whole house was white wood. It looked like a West Elm catalog, and that made me feel so good at the time. I was like, oh, I'm a grown-up. I'm elegant. And now I'm like, no, I like this color. I like this thing. I'm going to put it up. Bean likes awkward pauses. They happen to everybody, and if you try to avoid them, you only create them. A lot of times people are filling conversation with anything because they feel like they have to. But everyone always says that with the people closest to them, you can be quiet and you don't feel that you have to say or do anything. So I think an awkward pause are the point right before you go to that place with somebody, when the pause is no longer as awkward. She likes antique doorknobs. I was in Oaxaca, and I went to this antique store, and I remember seeing a bunch of doorknobs. I was like, these are so beautiful. So I have them scattered around, and I could point to every single one of them and remember where I got it. Frozen Charleston chews. Bean says, they remind me of growing up. It's like this marshmallow nougat thing that's covered in chocolate, and they got thrown in the freezer and turned crunchy. She loves René Magritte. He was one of the first artists where I was like, this version of surrealism feels so right to me. His version is so clean and simple. It's like everything has a tiny little message or a secret little hidden thing. For my last music video for Half of Me, I did an entire homage to him and created this cloud world. And Violet likes puppy paws. I love when a puppy has been sleeping and then you smell their paws. I was in Mexico for a very chill New Year's Eve and ended up bringing back a street dog puppy. I am exhausted, but her paws smell so good. They're warm and have that tired smell, and I'm just like, popcorn! Well, that is it for this week's reading of the Arts and Leisure section of the Sunday New York Times, the February 11th issue. I'm Rob Lund. Have a great day, and thank you for listening to Chris.